As a quarterback, I love sports. But sometimes when I get hit on my blind side, front side, and put on my backside, I wonder, is Sport Clips better than sports? Because Sport Clips haircuts is sports on TV, plus a relaxing haircut, hot steam towel, and massaging shampoo, which is better than sports plus Sport Clips. It's a game changer. Check in online at sportclips.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Before we get to today's wonderful guest, as always, let's draw your attention to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. There's lots of stuff there, including over 240 podcasts of really interesting people who have done really incredible things, like the guest I have on today. Also, I did launch a YouTube channel recently. You can go there. You can find it. I have all icons up there. But in this particular case, we are now over 1,000 subscribers, which is really cool because we start monetizing. Once we start monetizing, I can push those funds to Higher Ground, the charity that I support. I've supported for a long time now, over $150,000 to help people overcome their adversity in life, just like my daughter with the epilepsy does every single day. So please go subscribe to that channel. And always looking for a ratings and review with Finding Your Summit, help elevate the show popularity on Apple. That's always a big deal. And again, we're going to talk all things Everest today, but you can watch the NFL's film version of my journey up Mount Everest last year. There's a big red button you can push. It will take you right to the NFL 360 link. And from there, you can watch this 30-minute documentary, which, by the way, is up for an Emmy. So that's very exciting. On that note, let's get into today's guest. His name is Mick Conifree. Mick, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I was there's another guy that I've had on the pod, and his name is Mike Moreau. And Mike has skied all these mountains all over the world. Super impressive. He's climbed all these mountains. And he had pointed, like, hey, you need to talk to this guy about Mount Everest. He's writing a book on the 100th year anniversary of at least the attempt. I don't think George Mallory actually made it. He didn't. We don't think he did. But let's just start at the very beginning. Like, how, like, where did this come from? Why did you want to write about George Mallory?
I had worked for the BBC for many years making documentaries, and I specialized in doing films about mountaineering and exploration at a certain stage in my career. And so I made a film for the BBC on the 60th anniversary of the first ascent. So that was in 2013. And that told the story of Hillary and Tenzing. And I just got interested in that story. And from that, I made a film about K2. I made a film about Mount McKinley. I made a film about the Matterhorn. Mm. So I had been making a lot of documentaries, but it always struck me that we would find masses of research material which we could never include, and that writing books would be a way of kind of getting more out of the material that we'd researched. So, and that's hence that's led into the first book that I wrote about Everest, because I interviewed a lot of the original climbers from 53 and been all over the world, chasing down that story. But I got interested in the sort of whole history of Everest. And so this year, because it's the 100th anniversary of the first attempt, I thought it'd be a really interesting book to write. And it was obviously a difficult period because of COVID. There was no possibility to travel to Tibet or Nepal. And a lot of the archives that I wanted to work in were closed. But I was lucky. I managed to get into the main archive from the Everest expeditions is kept at the Royal Geographical Society in London. Mm. And I've just managed to get in there when nobody else was, and had great access to all the diaries and letters, and was able to build up this real picture of what it was like in 1922, which was so very different to how it is like now.
Yeah. No, there's So there's a lot there. Number one, I would love to see the film on the Matterhorn. I am attempting that this September in Mont Blanc. So I'm very excited about that big chunk of rock that goes straight up. But, you know, as I was going back and researching, and I'm a big history buff when it comes to Mount Everest and totally intoxicated by it. I'm so fortunate to have actually climbed it. There's a couple things. Number one, in 19, I think it's interesting to note that the British Empire really at that time was really leading the charges around the world in terms of trying to be the first to do a lot of different things. There was an exploratory mission that took place in 1921, which really then set up the 1922 attempt, which then ultimately led to the 1924 attempt, of which George Mallory not only failed to get, we think, but also passed away, fell down the mountain. And this last year, as I was standing, and I want to talk about more about why Nepal was shut down back in those days, so you couldn't climb it from the south. I climbed it from the south. And as I stood there and I looked at the Kumba Icefall, and I'm trying to picture myself back in 1953, and even though it's completely different on the other side of the mountain, coming from the north or Tibet, now controlled by China, I couldn't imagine standing there in like a tweed suit compared to what I was wearing and take on this beast. And you're looking up on top of the mountain, you can see all the winds blowing up there. And yeah, we had avalanches coming down every day. And it was just, it's just such a different environment. You know, I've climbed all the seven summits now, and I have been around the world, and there's just nothing like Mount Everest. And so, you know, going back, like, why was this such a priority? Was it George Mallory that was really pushing the envelope, or was it the British government? There was really the energy behind, we need to find somebody that can actually pull this off.
The government didn't have anything to do with it. It was very much about climbers wanting to do it. So I think as soon as Everest was measured in the 1850s and declared to be the highest mountain in the world, people wanted to climb it. But the problem was that the Everest is on the border of Nepal and Tibet. And at that time, both of those countries would not allow outsiders in, a little bit like Bhutan now, where all tourism is very tightly controlled, but basically the border is shut. And so in those days, you couldn't get into either Nepal or Tibet. You could only look at it from a distance. So when they measured it from 100 miles away, using very powerful telescopes and surveying equipment. And the British, because of the British Empire in British India, was the kind of regional power. China was kind of crumbling. Further north, there was Russia. And then to the south, there was British in India. And at a certain point, the Tibetans went to war with China and succeeded in throwing the Chinese out, because the Chinese Empire was really crumbling at this point. And they succeeded partly because they were given machine guns from the British. And so therefore, there was a relationship building up between British diplomats and the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan government. There was a lot of suspicion from Tibet. They weren't all that keen on allowing anybody in. But if they were going to allow anyone in at all, it was going to be the British, because they were the people who were in control to the south. And so basically the Royal Geographical Society, the Alpine Club, the climbers from there just kept on banging on the door, and they kept on being told they couldn't do it because British diplomats didn't really want to have anything to do with these oik climbers, you know, stop messing around in this very volatile part of the world and kind of proposing these useless, pointless climbing expeditions. We're not interested in it. But eventually they knocked on the door enough times for the British India office to approach the Tibetan government and say, will you allow this to happen? Then the Tibetans said yes. And so that's how in 1921, there was the first ever reconnaissance. They thought that they knew that they couldn't do it in one go. So they thought they would go and have a reconnaissance in 1921 and then come back in 1922 and make a proper attempt. So that's the kind of background to it. And the driving forces behind it, they harnessed the notion of patriotism and claimed that it would be enhancing the reputation of the British Empire. But that was really a way of making money. You know, if you've got to raise some money, then people bang the patriotic drum. But it, the government didn't have anything to do with it. All of the finance was private. So the money to actually stage the expedition came mainly from the Alpine Club, which is the sort of world's oldest mountaineering club. Mm-hmm. Half of it came from the Alpine Club. Half of it came from the Royal Geographical Society and their subscribers. And then a certain amount of money came from the press. But, you know, they would get, and the money was from just ordinary people. Some of them were very rich people, like the king gave some money or the Prince of Wales. And then there were other people who just gave a little bit of their pocket money because they liked the idea of this. They wanted to be part of the big adventure.
Sure. You know? Listen, I wish I would have found the British Empire, somebody that would have put some money in my coffers. That wasn't the case. I was the sponsor. I was the sole sponsor of these. But are you, you mentioned you've made films on all these different mountains.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the Matterhorn. And you mentioned Whidney, which Denali, which it was called McKinley for many years. Mm. But are you a climber yourself?
No, I'm a documentary maker. And so, but in order to make these films, I had to go to these places. And so, I've flown around the tip of the Matterhorn. I've flown around the summit of McKinley. I've climbed Fake Peak, the small peak on the Muldrow Glacier, which Frederick Cook claimed was Mount McKinley. And so I've done a lot of hard trekking and a bit of climbing in order to make the films, you know. But that's the direction. It was my hobby and I made films about my hobby. It was the other way around.
Yeah.
It was that I was a filmmaker and then a writer. And in order to do that, I had to go to these places. So, yeah, I know. So I've done a bit of climbing in South America.
Yeah, so no, I love it. I love it. So when I was climbing up to Mount Everest along the way, there was a number of different museums that they had celebrating Sir Edmund Hillary in Tenzing, Norway, and what they wore. And I was always, again, just completely fascinated by the whole thing. What are a few of the points that you, as you're doing your research, were blown away about? What were some of the most surprising things that you were taken back on, these guys actually trying to pull this off?
Well, I mean, you know, the first, the most amazing thing is just how high they got, you know, that on the first attempt in 1922, they got to over 26,000 feet. Mm-hmm. 1924, whether or not Mallory got to the summit, Norton, climbing without oxygen, got to 28,100 feet. I mean, that's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, climbing under his own steam, he was pretty wasted by the time he turned round, but nevertheless, he was able to do it. So, it is quite astonishing just how far they got. You know, and when it comes to the, you know, I it's a question which I found quite interesting, which is that, you know, that obviously their clothing was poorer than modern clothing in terms of thermal efficiency, you know, etc. And but I suspect they were a little bit hardier than people are now, and they were used to, you know, very tough conditions. And you know, they sort of, like, for example, they often deliberately slept with the tent door open because they wanted to encourage the circulation, you know, of the air. But in the end, the equipment doesn't make the climb, does it? As I'm sure you know. I mean, it is the sort of, you know, it obviously makes it easier, but it is the sort of the life force or the will to keep on going. But also they were sensible enough, or at least Norton and Somerville were sensible enough to turn back when they realized they'd reached their limit. It's astonishing, the chutzpah, really, the kind of ambition. All right. They just assumed they would get up it. You know, they just went for it. They didn't strategize in a way that now it all seems quite complicated and you have a big plan and you put up your camps higher and higher, and you think about it in a very sort of complicated way. Whereas they were very much, right, let's get onto the North Col and let's go, you know?
Yeah, no, the whole thing is incredible. A guy who's been on this podcast is Conrad Anker. And Conrad, of course, was part of an expedition a number of years ago to go find George Mallory and his partner, and they actually pulled that off. They found him, and they went through, and I actually saw a documentary on it. It was quite fascinating. And I think at the end of the day, what their hope was is that they had been equipped with two Vest Kodaks, small Kodak cameras, in their pockets, and hoping that that they once and for all solved the mystery. Did George Mallory actually make it to the top? And even though they found the body, and much of his body was intact, and they were found a lot of artifacts that confirmed that was the body of George Mallory, they did not find that Kodak camera. Based on all the stuff that you have researched, do you have a notion one way or the other that they actually made it to the top, or they didn't and they fell off the mountain to their deaths?
I think it's impossible to know, to be quite honest. They certainly died. There's no question of that. Yeah. Did they die on the way up, or did they die on the way down? Yeah. That's a more difficult question. And ultimately, you simply can't answer it, you know. And even if you find a camera, and even if in the camera there was some film which was possible to develop, would it really solve the mystery? I don't think so. I mean, you know, what sort of photograph proves that you're on the summit? I mean, so I'm not sure if the search for the camera, you can understand people's curiosity. And it is the case that cameras sometimes survive for a remarkably long time. There was a Swede who tried to fly over the North Pole in 1899, I think it was, called Solomon Andre, and his balloon crashed. And he died. He was eaten by a polar bear. And about 30 years later, they found the camp, their final camp, and they found their cameras. And they were able to take the cameras back and develop the photographs. So black and white, very simple black and white film survives for a remarkably long time. And especially in that environment where the humidity is very low. You know, everybody thinks of Everest and the Himalayas being very snowy, but in fact it's very dry sort of place. The humidity is really low, so that's why when they found Mallory's body, it was, you know, a lot of stuff was remarkably well preserved. So it is just possible they might find Irvin's body and then find this camera, but I don't really know whether it's going to prove anything. I mean, I think that from my knowledge of it, having seen Mallory's letters from 1924 and Irvin's letters from 1924, I think that they were pretty much at the end of the rope, and having one last go, having survived a very grueling expedition, and they weren't in perfect shape by any stretch. And they were climbing on oxygen, using oxygen sets which hadn't really been used very much during the expedition, you know, because they'd thought that they couldn't get enough oxygen cylinders up, so people weren't using oxygen machines. So, you know, if I was to hazard a guess, I'd say it was pretty likely that something went wrong with their oxygen sets, and that led to the accident. But equally, you know, Irvin was a novice climber, however physically strong he was. Yeah. And what they'd found in 1922 was that the higher up you got on the north side, the more difficult it became. That going up the north ridge, or the northeast ridge, was comparatively straightforward. But once you got quite close to the top and had to traverse out onto the north face, the climbing difficulties increased substantially. And so then this is what Mallory and Irvin were attempting to do. Mallory might have been capable of taking on the climbing, but was Irvin capable of it with so little experience? I mean, it's not a good recipe for if you're going to do it. This isn't exactly how you would do it, with using equipment which was not very well tested, using a climbing team, a pair who hadn't really climbed together during the expedition. That Irvin didn't think he was going to be part of the climbing team.
The odds were against them. And, you know, like anything, you don't normally go from, you know, something to something spectacular in one jump. It takes this iteration, you know. In your case, you live in the UK, and so soccer is big and in your country, and you don't get to go play for Liverpool or something, you know, the professional leagues without going through all the steps, you know, as a youngster playing the Little League. And that's a mistake, I think, even today, that too many people think that they can go pull off these major climbs, especially Mount Everest, by just paying a bunch of money and having people try to, you know, shepherd them up to the top of the mountain. It just doesn't work like that. And at the end of the day, if you don't put in the work, if you're not serious about what you do, if you don't really understand your craft, you know, the chances of you making it and or dying, you know, are, you know, stacked more in your favor of both those things happening to you. And I've seen it. I've stepped over bodies. I've had tent mates that I've been with that I saw up in Mount Everest. And it's the reality of what happens up there. And so, you know, you take that even with the best conditions and you scale it back 100 years and you start talking about these people and these guys that wanted to become, you know, do the first. And it was the whole idea of adventure. And nobody goes into anything thinking that they're going to die. They think they're going to keep rolling. And then things go wrong. When they go wrong and they go really fast and really bad, and which is exactly what happened to those guys.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. I know we were focused on this 1922 100 year anniversary of that, but Sir Edmund Hillary did not. Well, there was a gap between 1924 and 1953 in terms of the first person to ever summit Mount Everest, but I think there was some attempts in between that period of time, that those, you know, 25 years or so. Why was it so difficult, again, to ultimately achieve what Sir Edmund Hillary was able to finally accomplish? Was it just the technology? Was it the lack of the ability to get into Nepal? What was that that prevented somebody else from actually successfully doing that before Hillary was able to do that on top on 1953?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first of all, that yes, there were other attempts on Everest and on K2 and on Kanchenjunga in the 1930s, but none of the big Himalayan peaks were climbed until the 1950s. The first one was Annapurna in 1950, and then Everest, then Nanga Parbat, then K2, Lhotse, you know, all within the decade, virtually all of the kind of big mountains of the Himalayas had been climbed. So something happened in the 1950s that wasn't happening in the 1930s. Some of it was to do with technology, and certainly they did have better oxygen equipment, but it was still pretty primitive in comparison to what you have now, and it went wrong all of the time. And a lot of those big mountains weren't climbed on oxygen. Annapurna, they didn't use oxygen. Nanga Parbat, they didn't use oxygen. K2, the oxygen ran out just before the top. Everest, they used oxygen, but they had a lot of problems. So, but they had down clothing, for example. The 1953 British expedition was the first where they were kind of systematic about the science in a way that they hadn't been in the 1930s. People in the 20s and 30s weren't stupid, but they didn't systematically go out and say, like, let's try and find the best cloth to make clothes from. Let's try and find the best cloth to make tents from. Let's try and find the best boots. Let's systematically go through lots of different designs to find the optimum one. So certainly the technology had something to do with it. And during the Second World War, there'd been a lot of development for alpine regiments, mountain regiments. Mm-hmm. Most countries from America to Britain to Germany, Italy, they all had alpine regiments, even if they didn't actually do that much mountain fighting. But they spent a lot of time working on that. They spent a lot of time working on cold weather clothing. So by the 50s, you had things like down clothing, you had nylon climbing ropes, you had a lot of bits and pieces of technology, which was certainly better. But you also had a sort of post-war spirit, which in lots of fields of adventure was getting people to do things that they'd never done before. So, you know, in Britain, the 4-minute mile was broken by Roger Bannister.
Yeah.
I think 52, 51, just before Everest, you know, Thor Heyerdahl sailed from South America to Polynesia in the late 40s on, you know, the the Norwegians on the Kon-Tiki expedition. So I think immediately after the war, there was this kind of real can-do spirit with people willing to take risks, willing to push things a little bit harder. Edmund Hillary said, you know, that if you're going to get up Everest, you've got to take a few more risks. In the 1930s, the British climbing establishment was kind of risk averse up to a point, you know, that the feeling was that you should go push it as far as you can go, but not go too far. Whereas Hillary, I think, accepted that you had to go too far. And but it's also just that whole thing that once one person runs a sub 4 minute mile, then lots of people start doing it. You know, once the psychological, there was a psychological barrier which had to be broken. And obviously, I think it was ultimately probably easier in terms of Everest to climb up from the south side, although it wasn't easy, but probably marginally easier than from the north side, because in on both sides, the really difficult bits are right at the top. And so on the northern side, you've got all the rock steps. On the southern side, you've got the Hillary step, you know. Yeah. I think it's marginally easier to go via the Nepalese side. And that's why now, if you look at the numbers of people, more people climb it from the Nepalese side than climb from the Tibetan side. And so it was a significant change, Nepal opening its borders.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the reasons why I had a choice between going the north or the south, and I wanted to go from the south, which is Nepal, of course, because I really wanted to experience the Khumbu icefall. And going from the north, you know, while it's probably steeper yet slightly shorter, you know, it's just so unpredictable with the Chinese government, whether or not they want to shut down that border or not. That's what has kept people away. And this last year when I climbed it, they did have it shut down. There was actually a red line that they had painted up on top of the mountain on the peak, and they did not allow anybody to go on their side of the mountain for fear of COVID would be spread. So it was just kind of a bizarre thing. On the summit, there's a red line, right? Like, you know, on the summit, I'm sure you've seen it. I mean, literally it's you go up there and the summit isn't that big, and it's literally a peak, like a triangle. And on one side is Nepal, and the other side is Tibet, controlled again by China. And there was a red, right on the very top, the crest, you know, the point, there was a red line that was painted right across. Do not enter on this side, you know? So it was pretty clear, pretty crazy. So this book, Everest 1922, I think it is not out quite yet, but when do you expect the book to be out?
Available? It's coming out. It'll be out in England, in the United Kingdom, in early April, and then it's coming out in the US in early May.
And I assume we can all find this book on Amazon?
Yeah, it's on Amazon, all good bookshops, online and in shops. It's I think in America it's kind of called Pegasus Books.
Yeah, published. Sure, I know Pegasus. Okay, well, listen, man, I appreciate you coming on and explaining in a lot more detail the history behind this iconic mountain, all the people who have attempted it. I mean, it's fascinating. You know, people have been trying to tackle that thing for a long time. They still are. It still represents the pinnacle of success. And I feel so blessed and fortunate to be, you know, part of the club. But I can tell you it's no picnic. And I can't imagine what those guys were going through 100 years ago trying to do this with all the disadvantages that we have. Certainly today, it doesn't make it any easier, but certainly can help with the oxygen, the clothing and the ropes and all that kind of stuff that you mentioned. So I appreciate you coming on. And we will put in the show notes that this book will become available again, Everest 1922. It's going to be fascinating. Can't wait to read it. Available in the U.S. I think after May sometime, and hopefully everybody will go out there and buy it.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been fascinating talking to you, and well done for completing your 7 summits. I hope you do just as well on Mont Blanc and the Matterhorn.
I will need all the luck as always, but training surely going to help fuel my journey.
So, luck and judgment, that's what you need.
That's right. All right, there he is, the one, the only, Mick Conifery. Thank you so much.
Well done.
All right, buddy.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.